Judge Pawar, welcome to our fun Women's History Month podcast. My name is Ruchi Kapoor. I'm the Vice President of the Denver Bar Association. It's nice to chat with you. If you want to introduce yourself.
Thanks for having me, Ruchi. I appreciate it. I'm really honored to be included in your spotlighting of Women's History Month. My name is Neethi Pawar, and I'm a judge on the Colorado Court of Appeals. And I was appointed 2 years ago this month.
So just to backtrack and to get started, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your path to the bench. What interested you? You know, how did you start thinking about being a judge on the Colorado Court of Appeals?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I think it's really more, it's one of those things where the opportunity presented itself and I was able to sort of self-reflect and take advantage of an opportunity that presented itself. And then I was lucky enough to be able to make it through the process, actually get the appointment. So what do I mean by that? I didn't set out to become a judge. I know that for a lot of people, that was their dream. That was the reason they went to law school, or once they started practicing and, they were in court, they saw the position of a judge and said, you know, that's what I want to do one day. And I can't say that I ever had that I ever said, that's what I want to do one day. But that's kind of consistent with my entire career trajectory. It really has been more like, what am I enjoying? How does it align with my skills? Where am I at in my life? You know, because we evolve professionally, personally, in theory, that's for me anyway, part of the evolution of growth and everything else. And so, you know, as that changed over time, it went from, you know, being in the courtrooms as a public defender every single day to going into private practice and having more ongoing in-depth relationships with clients and business development. And from there, it went to mediations where I really found myself thinking, gee, I really am pretty good at this problem solving. Even though I was a litigator, I really kind of had more of my highs from working things out, understanding the perspective that everybody is bringing to the table, how, you know, different interests aligned or didn't align, and how to reach kind of common goals. And so that's, you know, what steered me into mediation. And interestingly, I think that's part of what ultimately then, like I said, drew me to taking advantage of this opportunity and seeing it as an opportunity that aligned with something that I think most people wouldn't connect with the judicial path. I don't think people think, oh, become a mediator because that's the way that you'll end up becoming a judge. I was a solo practitioner also. That's not really the well-worn path to the bench. Be a solo practitioner with a heavy focus on domestic relations and then mediate. And somehow that's really, you know, the soundest way to get appointed to the bench. But when I look in hindsight, I think about, it really has always been, I think my interest in pursuing the bench is consistent with everything I've done in the past that has been towards service, right? Serving individuals, serving the profession. And I think this was a natural kind of next step. And I know that that's also very cliche, like, oh, it just seems like it's the next step in my career. But I don't mean it in that sense of like, you have to take the next step and here are the linear steps one must take. But in terms of, you know, what you should do versus how, for me, my skills and my passions and my interests evolved and developed, I think it led me towards where I am now. And you know, as an appellate court judge, it's a lot of problem solving, and it's the ability to untangle, a situation, a story. You know, there are people behind the stories and the legal issues that we're dealing with. And being able to have that, the problem solving lens, which is removed from the emotion of it. And that's a lot of what the feedback I got as a mediator was, you know, you're good at this and we like coming to you as a mediator because you strip away that emotion and you focus on the legal issues. But stripping away the emotion, I think, is also separate from stripping away the humanity. And there's a nuance there. And I think that's part of what I bring and why, again, service is ultimately what drove me to applying for and pursuing this position.
I think that's so interesting because, you know, like a lot of people talk about, or at least like a lot of people, I think, bring this idea or this concept that they wanted to be judges from like day one of law school, right? Day one of 1L year, they walked in thinking, okay, I want to be a judge. And, you know, it sounds like your path was a little bit more meandering than that. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that you seem to have taken the approach of what is the best fit for me at this point in my professional development. And I find that to be a really unique way of thinking about the bench. In terms of when it came time to apply, you know, you said that you viewed it as an opportunity. What were the things that you think kind of really perfectly aligned to make you feel, okay, this is the moment that I'm going to turn in my application?
Yeah, I, you know, at the time I was still pretty actively involved with the South Asian Bar Association, and we get those notices of the vacancies. And part of the mission of SABA Colorado is to, you know, advance and promote and recruit and try to mentor the development of South Asian lawyers through in the state of Colorado, including appointments to the bench. So part of, I think I was wearing that hat, and I would look at these vacancies and say, okay, who do we know that would we should encourage? Who do we know that we should encourage who may be thinking, I might want that one day, maybe now, maybe not, or maybe somebody who I think would be a good candidate, but may not have it in their own minds. Like, hey, this is something that you have thought about. And I started thinking about, you know, what are the skills that we would want to see in a court of appeals judge? And I started going through the list and I was like, well, that kind of describes me. So, and it really was about where I was in my career. So I had done the, like I said, in the trenches, public defender work, the business development, a solo practitioner, running my own practice, being the entrepreneur, founding a bar association, you know, a lot of leadership stuff and a lot of like the trial work and again, the problem solving and helping people through crises and settlement, reaching settlement, crossing T's, dotting I's, understanding how, you know, you need to interpret the law to like be able to navigate for individuals and then also explain to individuals, clients, what their options are and why one thing may make sense or something doesn't make sense. And I know that I was doing appellate work at the same time I was mediating. And so I would have days in a row where I was all FaceTime with people, just very engaged with and on in terms of the personality and the connection and all of that emotional intelligence work was all in the forefront. And it's exhausting, and listening for 8 hours in a day is absolutely exhausting. And then I would have days where I'm doing the appellate work and it was, you know, show up into my office in comfortable clothes and make sure I have all my snacks and you shut the door and just nerd out on reading and writing and, you know, doing that research. And that balance of being able to, I didn't want to do either of those things 100% of the time. And so I thought, and I think that's why when I saw the position open that and I had never thought about Court of Appeals. I mean, I had just did not think this was something that was available to me in so many ways. And so I thought, you know, I really like this interaction, this sweet spot of the intellectual rigor, but also understanding that there is a public service to this. And that, again, there are people behind the appeals. But also the integrity of the judicial process, you know, and how, you know, there are ways and there are limited ways that an appellate court judge can have influence. You know, and all of that, I think, just intersected for me. And that's why I said, okay, I'll go ahead and fill out this application and highlight those things. And, you know, and through the course of doing that, of course, I saw hey, I have certain areas of this application that may look really different, that do look very different than other applicants, and other things that look very different, I think, in unique ways, that I can convey why that difference is important and why that difference of experience, being a solo, being a person who had had the family law experience, and not somebody who had just been, you know, kind of that well-worn path to the bench. And maybe that's something we want in terms of making sure we have a lot of perspectives and experiences represented on the bench.
I think that's so interesting. And part of what just really struck me about what you said was that you mentioned that you felt that until you started filling out the judicial application, that going to the Court of Appeals was just something that wasn't in your reach or in your, you know, exactly something that you had pushed for or strived for. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because I think that's something that, you know, especially as we talk about being women of color in the legal profession and what that means to your background, where do you think that barrier came from in your mind, if you can trace it, and how did you kind of push through it?
Yeah, it's a good question, Ruchi. I think it's like, not that the barrier was created, it's just that the path or the doors didn't just naturally appear open to me. And I think that just comes from, again, a lot of the things that you know, I kind of touched on, which is, you know, we are the sum of all the things, right, that influence us. And I don't know if it's because I'm a woman. I don't know if it's because I'm a woman of color. I don't know. You know, I grew up in a really small town in central Western Illinois. I mean, it is farm town, you know, heart of Midwestern, of like whatever, the heartland of the United States, Midwestern Illinois. There was no major city near us. There was no major highway. Like the nearest interstate was like 3 hours away, you know, like, so, you know, that forms a person. And, you know, public schools, very small. There was no sort of like, hey, here's how, there were no AP classes. There was no somebody, a career counselor saying you really seem to be connecting with this kinds of, you know, justice issues, or you should join debate, or I mean, none of that existed. And then it's coupled with what I think you were maybe getting at, which is this idea that I'm the daughter of immigrants, and the immigrant, that first wave of immigrants of Indian Americans, of Indians from India to America, you know, it came because there was a shortage of physicians in rural towns in Illinois. And so there was a lack of resources of medical providers. And so if you were a physician from India, you were invited to apply for a visa to come to the States. And part of that is like, hey, what a great idea. Because before that, visas were not granted to people from India. We were not allowed to come to America. So the first wave of immigrants were all very highly educated, entrepreneurial, independent spirit, you know, sort of, you know, travel-minded, worldly. And, you know, so I think that brings with it this idea of you come to the States and now you settle. I think another common theme, which is maybe is a different podcast, is is that a lot of our parents came and they didn't plan on staying. I mean, I know that goes for my parents, and I know it goes for a lot of the parents, the community that I was around growing up. It was, you know, go when you're young, explore, you have this opportunity, you know, live in the States. And then when it's time to like settle down, have a family, you go back to India. And that just didn't pan out. It wasn't intentional for my parents. It didn't pan out because they didn't have the resources to get back, basically. And so all of that is to say, when I think people who grow up in families where there is a legacy of lawyers, judges, maybe politicians, you know, whatever it is, you're immersed in it. And that conversation around the dinner table or the people you have in your homes that you see your parents socializing with, they're they're lawyers, they're judges, they're people in that world. And that was not something I grew up with. I grew up with all physicians around me. And so it wasn't that I didn't, going back to your question of why did I see that it wasn't something available to me? Because I didn't ever see it. It was never exposed. I wasn't exposed to it. I didn't grow up with this idea of what it meant to be a lawyer. I didn't know any lawyers until I went to law school and interned, you know, for a lawyer. You know, and so it felt something that was just very, very distant. It felt like something that was very separated from just the world that I knew. And I think it was, you know, how did I overcome it was the second part of your question. I don't know that I overcame it. I think it was sort of taking that step forward and like turning the doorknob and opening the door and saying, oh, what is this? It is available to me. Like, why wouldn't it be? I have gone to law school and I have practiced and I have a breadth of experience. And so I think that suddenly made it more real. And people like, you know, I talked to people like Judge Fox and I talked to, you know, Judge Ashby before she retired. And I think speaking to women like that made it, like I said, a little bit more tangible. And it goes back to the whole idea of like, you can't be what you don't see, right? And so it just wasn't around and I didn't see it. And once I sort of sought it out, then it became a little more tangible and possible.
I think that's, you know, like that's so profound to think about, you know, because sometimes it can feel really like you're having this very isolated experience, but you know, like I relate so much to everything that you just said. And I think part of it is that like, it creates this like very stubborn streak of independence, for lack of a better phrase for it. Because I think it makes you very, you know, self-empowering. I guess that's what I'm looking for, is like, you seem like the engine that pushed you forward was like your own self-empowerment, right? Like you kind of were like, oh, there is a door here, you know, and you looked for opportunities. And I think that strikes me as something so unique to you and your personality and the story that you just told me. How do you think that kind of independent viewpoint and, you know, like self-empowerment affects where you are now on the bench and like how you view cases and kind of your day-to-day? Like, how do you think that kind of affects it as you move forward?
Well, first of all, I appreciate that sort of way to frame it, because I don't know that I would have described it that way. But I think you touch on something, which is we do have to find ways that may not just naturally be in front of us because of our family legacy or history. And I think that there is a sense of nobody's going to bring it to you, right? Nobody's just going to like put it in front of you and say, here's this opportunity for you. You really have to go find it and get it. And I can't remember the rest of your question. So, how does that affect my current, my short-term memory is really.
I'm glad you remembered, because I totally forgot. So,
Yeah, the self-empowerment. I think that comes with time also. I'm not sure that I would have ever thought that from the beginning. But now, having said that, I think about, I mean, I moved to Colorado. I went to law school in Illinois and I just needed to leave the Midwest. I needed to get out from the Midwest and I wanted to move west, and I didn't want to take the bar in California, didn't want to live on the coast. So, and I skied. So I was like, I'll just go to Denver. I mean, really not very thoroughly considered. But like it turned out to be such a fantastic move for me. And, you know, I didn't have a network. I didn't have a job lined up. And so I think, again, it's that a little bit of naivete, but also coupled with maybe that, you know, you're calling it self-empowerment. I think I've just in the past called it scrappiness. Like, just go there and figure it out and meet people and make yourself uncomfortable and go to awkward, you know, like networking events until it becomes a little more comfortable. And what you're calling self-empowerment, I think, is just becoming comfortable in your own skin, you know, and getting that assuredness that way. So how does that affect what I do now? It was a little bit from that standpoint. Part of what's so exciting about it is everything was new all over again. Literally, like how I went to work, the path that I drove to work, having a parking garage, having a badge to swipe in, having this, having clerks. You know, I've never had dedicated, you know, support people, and so just everything, and then all of my colleagues and the structure, all of the new systems, and the fact that it's like, it's government, it's bureaucracy. All of that was new, but being a solo where I was soup to nuts, you know, the IT person, the billing person, the lawyer, and everything else. So all of it was really different. And I think part of that, my experience just doing things like, all right, well, just you think you're interested in doing that? Try it. Go, just try it. What's the worst that can happen? And I think that being comfortable in the discomfort of the unknown and uncertainty, I think, is what has helped me now acclimate, adjust, you know, just get to know new people and, yeah, the whole new system of everything. You know, but there's also like, again, like I keep coming back to like Judge Fox, and there's a couple of other judges that have just been tremendous in terms of, you feel like there's somebody who a little bit is looking out for you. Just little reminders. Hey, you may not know this, but like you've got this, you know, our financial disclosure filings are due, you know, and just a little nudge, because there isn't really, there's not really, I mean, there is literally a manual, but there isn't really like a manual, like how to do this job. and it's really, a lot of it is on the job learning. So yeah, having a few of those relationships, I think, has really been impactful and helpful.
I think, you know, as you talk about it, I also wonder about, you know, like your relationship with your law clerks, and like, how do you mentor them? And like, what are kind of the nuggets of advice that you would give them, or any younger attorney that is thinking about, you know, one day being on the bench or thinking about applying? What would be your nuggets of advice there?
I think, you know, the advice I give, it's sort of all, I have several thoughts coming to the forefront at the same time, so I'll just sort of spit them out. You know, one is this idea of mentorship, right? Find a mentor, but it's not just find a mentor. It's really find someone that you connect with. You know, and because that whole concept of mentorship, it isn't one size fits all. You know, it's not just find somebody who's in the job that you want and then ask them, what do I need to do to get here? Because the way that they got there and their personality and their station, you know, or location, whatever it is, it may not work for you. And so it's really having that relationship with somebody who sort of can guide you in the ways that are going to resonate with you. Because getting into the next sort of nugget, because it needs to be something that you can be authentic about and have genuine passion around. Because when you're sort of told like, do this, this, and this, and if you're not feeling it, that energy comes off. And so the whole idea of like, join this organization or sit on this board, do this kind of work. If you're not connecting with it and it falls flat, I think that the people around you see it, and you know, yourself don't feel fulfilled. And I think that can, you know, hold you back in the longer term. And so when it comes time to pursuing whatever opportunity it might be at the bench or some position, you know, in any organization, when you call on people and say, hey, I'm pursuing this, if they just feel like, you know, she didn't ever seem very enthusiastic or passionate, I never got that like sense of connecting, all of that stems from a lack of your own, like if you start with yourself, your own internal ability to to care, to be authentic. So you have to find ways to do what you're doing in authentic ways, because then that translates to other people, and those other people are the people who will interview you or be hiring you or writing you recommendation letters, or, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it is finding mentors and seeking out the people who you sort of value the way that they have done it, and they can see in you your unique, you know, personality, approach, whatever it is, so that it will work for you, instead of trying to have that square peg round hole, like, oh, do this in this methodical way. And if it doesn't ever fit for you, it's not going to, it'll show and it'll fall flat. But that's really been valuable for me. I mean, always having, my very first jury trial was in front of Judge Claudia Jordan in Denver Municipal Court. And she's the first African-American woman appointed to the bench in the state of Colorado. And, you know, after that trial, she put me into chambers and she gave me all kinds of advice. And it was stuff like that, again, it's not that one size fits all. It felt like it was very specific to me. And she's like, here are the things that I see in you that I think you can, you know, emphasize here, but you have to be careful because of this or here, you know, and it was so personal. And I think that she was able to give me that kind of feedback because of who she is. And then being a partner with Gary Jackson, Judge Jackson's the same thing, you know, there was just a different lens that he was able to kind of, you know, give me feedback and advice. And so finding your, it's that, find your people, right? And then also having the outlet, not just like, oh, every relationship has to be in this very highly professional setting, but finding your people that you can, you know, let your hair down and just breathe a little bit and be yourself, because it can be a tough profession, right? And so having your, you know, having your crew that you can unwind with and just, you know, get some, I don't want to say validation, but just, and at that level of understanding where we're like, yeah, I know what you're saying. I feel that too. So yeah, find your advice, the nuggets, I would say, find your, you know, have your crew, find your mentors in terms of like meaningful ways. And when you follow the advice of your mentors, then do find avenues that you can do that with authenticity that align with your values and your passion.
I think those are all really important nuggets of wisdom. And I think that takes me to the end of my list of questions. So thank you so much, Judge Pawar, for joining us and for kind of bearing with me on my little project. I think this has been really, really enlightening. And I hope that everyone who listens to what you have to say kind of takes some of those and sits with them, because I think those are really important pieces of advice for anyone that's thinking about applying to be on the bench. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you again for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and to explore these ideas. So thanks for doing it.